Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Shabbat Torah program and to Yada Yada Radio. If I am correct in translating, I don't claim to be great at Greek. I don't much like Greek. Neither Yahweh nor Yosha ever spoke Greek. But in the what's called the Olivet Discourse, where Yosha is explaining the seven signs that are going to occur prior to his return, one of those is Megos Seismos, is how it was translated. And Megos Seismos would mean significant turning, significant movement of either land, water, or air. And therefore, it is the seismic scale talks about the quaking of the earth. But tornadoes and hurricanes are also in the category of megaseismos. We measure them on different scales. But it is indeed telling, since they were predicted to be birth pangs, which means they would increase in frequency and intensity as we near Yahweh's return, that in the last little over a week, the United States has been hit by a Category 4 storm, Harvey, that wiped out much of southeastern Texas. And now is about to be hit by a far bigger storm, Hurricane Irma, which, you know, they talk about it being bigger than all of Florida. It's much bigger than all of Florida. It's like five times wider than the state of Florida. Yeah, the thing is bigger than the state of Texas. And it is an absolute monster. And on top of that, there was an 8.1 Richter scale earthquake in Mexico yesterday, and I think even one in Japan. I don't think the one in Japan was at that significance, but oh my. Now, I have shared for a considerable time a refutation of the concept of man-made global warming, because the research that I've done, I'm not the researcher, I've simply read the research that is available to anyone. Anyone can do the same study that I did, which is to look at the climate history of the planet to determine whether or not the warming period that we are now experiencing is something that is new to this planet, or something that is part of the cycle of the planet that has been manifest long before man was around and long before fossil fuels were burnt. And what you find is that the research confirms by digging out core samples from around the world, particularly in the oceans, which are the most affected by temperature change. And they show organisms living and dying that are prone to survive in either warm or cooler waters at various periods, revealing that the Earth has, for millions of years, gone through periods of hot and cold that last, on average, 600 years. And you can trace them even through the short history of humankind. While Homo sapiens have been around for hundreds of thousands of years, written history regarding them, where we can say, understand what the climate was like, is only about 6,000 years old. It commenced when Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden with the Nasama, and they left with Hebrew as a language. And at that time, we have records now of what the conditions were like for humankind. And what we find is that you can trace through this history of man a consistent period of 600 years of warmer than average weather, followed by 600 years of cooler than average weather. You know, while there is a larger cycle in the range of 10,000 years that deals with, you know, the major ice ages, there's also this shorter cycle, and it's manifest throughout human history. We began a warming period, ended what was called the Little Ice Age, a cooling period that caused all the upheaval in Europe, starvation, made it possible for the bubonic plague, the Black Death, to kill so many in Europe because they were already malnourished as a result of the cooling period, where crops do not grow as well. And we came out of that cooling period around 1850, which is the beginning of the time the glaciers, which had reached their maximum potential during the cooling period, began to retreat. Seawater levels would begin to rise. Average temperatures rose. Now, the reason I'm sharing that is that when Yosha talked about these megaseismos and therefore more hurricanes and tornadoes, these are warm weather, warm water, warm, moist environment phenomena. They do not occur when it's cold and dry. And so there's every reason to recognize that we are going to get more of them. And it's going to be devastating. It's exactly what God predicted. And when he predicts things, he's not saying that he is the cause of them. This is not an act of God. He just said, this is what's going to happen. And indeed, it is happening, and it's unstoppable. You know, by the time we do this program a week from now, it's going to be, it could be that the United States suffers the two greatest natural calamities in its history. And that they'd be back-to-back over a course of a two-week period. Remarkable, isn't it?
Indeed. You know, there's another one right behind us.
There is one right behind it, and it is tearing up the same islands, particularly the U.S. and British Virgin Islands being the hardest hit. They were destroyed. They were decimated. I mean, there's maybe 1 in 10 buildings that is still habitable on those islands, and they're being hit again. But the one that is following it is headed towards Bermuda. It's headed due north here shortly, so it's not going to impact heavily populated areas. But oh my, folks! You know, I don't know if we have any listeners in Florida. If so, get out. I know we had have had many in Texas. I'm sorry for your great loss and suffering. This has been a hellacious time for America. What I'd like to do is return to where we were, but before I do, since it's fresh in my mind, about 10 minutes ago, I finished translating what's called the ninth verse of Yeshaya 7. We're going to return to the 14th chapter of Observations for Our Time, which covers Yeshaya 5. But I have subsequently, since I did that, translated all of the sixth chapter of Yeshaya, which is quite an indictment against man. And I'm now in the seventh. And in the seventh chapter, the ninth verse, I think, should not be connected to everything that goes before it in the ninth verse, and it really should be attached to what follows. It comes out of the blue, and with the way that English Bibles are written, that they, so you ask for a sign, and I'm going to give you a sign. The sign shall be that a virgin shall give birth to a child. And it's just kind of like, why the sign? Why in the middle of all of this? Who's asking for it? Well, this is the statement that I translated just before the show began. It reads as follows. If you do not trust and rely, then indeed you will not endure. If it's him, you do not trust and rely, lo aman, then indeed he, surely as a result, you will not be accepted nor established. You will not be considered trustworthy nor be confirmed in the relationship. You will not have any confidence, nor will you be attended to or nurtured. That's about as black and white as it gets, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Very much.
If you do not trust and rely, then you will not endure. Then you will not be accepted. You won't be considered trustworthy. You will not be confirmed in the relationship. You will have no confidence. It's the condition of the covenant, you know.
Yeah.
Trust and rely on Yahweh. And the reason that that statement is so important, of course, is that it is impossible to trust anyone that you do not know. And you cannot rely on anything you do not understand. So to be able to trust and rely, you have to know and understand them. And the reason the statement is powerful. The reason I think that it is misplaced in the way that chapters and verses were enumerated while that funky British dude was riding his horse. It is the lead into, so you want a sign. Well, why a sign? It's the reason that you come to trust and rely. You know, in the midst of all this end times prophecy regarding Yisrael and Yehuda that we've considered through the first now five and soon to be six and seventh chapters of Yeshaya, in the seventh, he goes to something that's happening right at that time. And that is a failed attempt by Syria in league with Ephraim, the northern kingdom, to terrorize and then divide Jerusalem, splitting it between the kingdoms of Syria and the northern kingdom. And it's a current event happening right then, and Yahweh says, just chill. Don't say a thing. Listen. Be quiet. And be especially observant. Because I'm not going to allow this to happen. And you say, well, why in the world is he going to a current event? I think the reason should be obvious. I think it's twofold. One is that we can verify the divine inspiration behind the prophecies in Yeshaya, because we can look at them through a 2,700-year window of history, and the ones that have not occurred are being manifest before our very eyes in these last 15 or 16 years. So we have the benefit of time to validate that what we are reading is reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way we can trust and rely, is to know, to validate the claim so that we know that they are reliable, so we can trust and rely upon them. Well, Yeshaya's audience would find no benefit in a virgin bearing a child. That wouldn't happen for another 700 years. They would find no benefit in knowing that Yah was going to lift a banner up in a faraway place in the last days. That wouldn't happen for another 2,700 years. Right?
Yeah.
So, for them to be given the opportunity to trust and rely, which requires verification, Yahweh would have to say something that would affect their lives. And so that's one of the reasons he tells the story. The other reason he tells the story is that what he has to say about Syria and the northern kingdom, Ephraim, wanting to sack and control Jerusalem.
Very familiar to us.
Should be familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
We should see the Muslims and so-called Palestinians wanting to do the same thing.
With the help of Ephraim.
Yeah. And awesome. We should recognize it ain't going to happen.
Hmm.
It ain't going to happen. And by the way, he ties it all to Damascus, too, and ties it to Samaria. Now, the reason those things are important is, what does the world want to give to the Muslims?
The West Bank.
The West Bank. What is the West Bank?
The West Bank.
Samaria. It's Samaria. And the most vicious anti-Israelite terrorist group in the world calls what city its capital?
Damascus.
Yeah, Damascus. That would be Hezbollah. Yep. And, of course, when we read further in Yeshaya 17, what we learn is that because of the fall of Damascus to the Islamic terrorists, that the Neville Chamberlain Act of the world is to give the Muslims Samaria, the high ground of Israel, in hopes of appeasing their bloodlust. So it is a fascinating read, and I can assure you that once we're finished with chapter 5 of Yeshaya, we will not have run out of good material.
No.
there will be more opportunity to learn. All right, I want to just review Yeshaya 5, 8, and 9 before we, actually 5, 8, 9, and 10 quickly. Then we'll dive into 11. The second stanza, if you will, of the five stanzas, the five refrains that comprise Yeshaya 5, this song that Yahweh has composed to his beloved, to Dod, reads, "Woe. This is a warning about a disastrous situation and a cautionary tale to those of you in the land, connecting house to house, field to field, and plot with plot, territory to territory, who approach and present themselves, joining together until such a point in time that there are no more places nor sites to build housing units, offices, or even to stand. And they will be made to dwell alone, living isolated and separated." That is the primary thrust of the politics vis-a-vis Israel between the United States, Europe, Russia, China, and the Muslim world. Cause Israel to be isolated and separated as a result of the housing units that it's building. This is a precisely accurate prediction. I am hearing, Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual implements, declares that doubtless there will be no houses for many, because as an object of appalling scorn, ridicule, and derision, there shall be horrible terrorism and devastating desolation. Even the largest and most beautiful home will be without an inhabitant. Because then 10 acres of vineyard shall produce one daughter, a malleable, fragile offspring is what will come from her. It is something we spent a considerable amount of time on last week, but you know, as a quick review, the fact is that housing units the area of Jerusalem, it's different in other places, but in greater Jerusalem, the houses are all connected. They're housing units. They're not independent single-family homes. It's wall-to-wall, ceiling-to-ceiling, floor-to-ceiling, wall-to-wall. And they're running out of space to build. And they're being terrorized for building them. They are an object of ridicule and derision and scorn and suffer terrorist attack daily. And it's going to get worse to the point that the most beautiful homes will be uninhabited. And then this 10 acres of vineyard will produce one daughter. We spent 40 minutes or so on that. Yeah, that was really profound. What is an acre? How is it measured? Why is it a daughter that he's talking about? What does that mean relative to the current population? And what you find is, if you look at the numbers for Greater Jerusalem, you find that it is essentially decimation. It's to decimate is 1 in 10 survives. Now, that does not mean that 9 out of 10 are killed. But it means that 9 out of 10 either flee, realize they can no longer live in Jerusalem because of the terrorism, they flee. They're captured as sex slaves, which Muslims are wont to do with Christians and Jews. Or they're killed, one of the three. Now, while that is interesting, as I was translating Yeshaya 6, these last few days, what percentage of Yisrael do you think Yahweh says survives? I always thought it was a third. It's not a third. He tells us exactly what percentage of Yisraelites survive until his return. What percentage do you think it is?
Thank you, Sam.
Nope.
7%.
I just did the math. 1 in 10.
How was that? 1 in 10?
Oh, wow. 1 in 10. It's the exact same math as if you take the present female population of Greater Jerusalem and you reduce that to one daughter for every 10 acres. It's 9 out of 10 are gone. He says that he's going to leave a tenth, but he's not going to leave a tenth. A tenth will be left. The remnant upon his return is 1 out of 10. It's interesting when these things correspond, isn't it? Now, even the women that are left are going to be malleable and fragile. Then this, we pick up on new material, 5:11, and it reads, "Whoa, this is a warning. to those who rise early in the morning with intoxicating liquor and continue into the twilight to drink and are inflamed with wine. When a person begins drinking early in the morning and continues to drink all day, they are an alcoholic. When they are an alcoholic, they are typically abusive. They are impossible to live with. They are incapable of being contributing members to the to society. Their thinking is dulled. Their hearts are poisoned, and they very seldom live very long, shorten lives. Even their skin becomes this toxic color. And so, could the GI will be speaking about alcoholism? Yeah, there's a lot of people that today that are alcoholics. Could he be talking about, there wasn't a term back then for drugs, but could he be talking about people that are drugging themselves, you know, starting with the prescription painkillers early in the morning and continuing with them all day long? Absolutely. You know, I live most of the time in the heroin capital of the world. And fentanyl is the new synthetic form that is much cheaper and much more deadly and even more prevalent. It's the leading cause of death in the surrounding counties in southwestern Ohio. And it's growing exponentially. People are drugging themselves to death. So those are two ways to look at it. There is a third way to look at it.
Yeah,
and that is that when a person either gets in with the wrong spirits or their judgment is impaired by the intoxicating effect of society, then they're like this. When you can be intoxicated by video games, playing them all day, it's addictive. You can be intoxicated by conspiracy theories and let them affect you, and they will affect your judgment. So it could be, you know, one of the many people that are just absolutely enamored. You know, they just gorge themselves on political news, poisoned by it. So I think that there's a toxicology associated with things that are just poisonous. Religion, politics, all the other things.
When is the first prayer of the day in Islam?
Yeah,
usually around 5:30 to 6 a.m. And the last one's around dusk.
Yeah.
Poisoning themselves with the intoxicating liquor of their religion.
Yes. And literally being poisoned by demons. Intoxicating spirits. Would you find that, Kirk?
I found tons of references to religion. We get the same term with La'om Sharim is in Proverbs, and it says to remain behind to drink mixed wines, which are drink offerings, and considered uses in religious context. I got later in Yayin, wine is a metaphor for, they call it wisdom's drink, a wine bibber, or the confusion of Babel. I mean, it's just about four or five of these words are these terms. I did the words and also the terms. And it's all religion. It's the followers to pursue and chase, or Rudolph to pursue and chase. Then you look over and you keep digging, and it says to follow after wickedness, and after, which is another term. And another term in Psalms is to follow after religious or the sun god type of worship.
Yeah,
so
all
the above count. I mean, that's
one
thing
that the religious connotations are consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me tell you why I think there's a consequence.
Okay.
You know, the consequence is valid. I mean, that consequence is extraordinarily valid. But the thing about alcohol is that in an overabundance, an inebriated individual has their judgment impaired.
Mm-hmm.
the single most important thing that we possess as humans is a nesama, the ability to be rational, to exercise good judgment. There is nothing more valuable to us. It is the only way to know and trust and rely upon Yahweh, to understand what he's offering. If your nesama is not functional and isn't exercised and isn't operating at its highest capability, you got no hope.
No.
Yep.
You know, I think that there's some references in this chapter to the people we've disassociated with who have spent way too much time in the artificial world of Facebook, of social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally found the passage in Yeshaya 6, where Yahweh himself is precluding from happening what we experienced, saying that he doesn't want it to happen, which is that he wants people to be blinded and be deaf, because people that are still fixated on politics and religion and who exercise poor judgment, and you're exercising poor judgment if you're into conspiracy theories, I'll tell you that, he doesn't want them to associate with him. He doesn't want them to figure it out. Now, that might sound harsh, but that's what I came, you know, when we were dealing with the Fred going off the wagon and becoming so anti-Israel, so anti-Semitic, so anti-Yahweh. You know that Yahweh doesn't want to deal with that. I don't want to deal with that for eternity. And so God has literally created a mechanism where he says, that's the last thing I want these religious and conspiratorial and political people doing, is to figure out enough about me that they start associating their lies with me to give people the false impression that I approve of what they're doing and saying.
I don't want that to happen. I mean, that's what
Absolutely.
He did. He had just enough religious understanding or enough rabbinical understanding, poor understanding, to mix it all up into a terrible, toxic mess.
Right. So if by using the Hebrew words for intoxication, what Yahweh is talking about is impaired judgment. And if your judgment is impaired, then you are incapable of understanding. And there is a gargantuan difference between knowing and understanding. HaSatan knows Yahweh, but he most certainly isn't part of the covenant family. Knowing and understanding are chasms apart, and the only thing that can get you from one to the other is exercising good judgment. And if that's impaired, then you're going to be played for a fool by religion, anti-Semitism, conspiracies, political mantras. You are going to be taken advantage of, and you're not going to have the sense to be able to differentiate between good and bad, truth and lies.
You're talking earlier about, you know, various types of impairment and intoxication. You know, like you talked about painkillers. Yeah, I'll speak from personal experience. When I had my accident, I was on painkillers, and I tried to sit down a few times and, you know, do some studying. I'm like, I'm at home. I've got nothing else to do. I can't work. I can sit in front of the computer. I could not concentrate long enough to read anything. Now, by that same token, I'll sit down and I'll pour myself a beer, and I'll sit down and start going in and studying and translating and do all that, and it doesn't impair my judgment if I drink it in moderation.
Correct.
So,
I love
the alcohol, it's all about that impairing.
Right. And one of the things, too, that's interesting is without alcohol, we wouldn't be here.
Society wouldn't exist.
That's right. Society wouldn't exist. I don't think humankind even exists without alcohol.
Right.
Because we'd all have poisoned ourselves. You know, when people live together in a community, even if they live in proximity to animals and drink water without boiling it, and no one knew to boil it until fairly recently, without alcohol, the water will kill you. And so it's interesting from that point of view. There's another interesting aspect of it, of course, is that alcohol, the fungus that is used to ferment the alcohol, it's gone. It's dead. It ceases to function once the alcohol is brewed and by the time it's being consumed. And so there's a tie into with the concepts of matzah and of course with wine, a tie in with Pesach. But anyway, if you're drinking all day, then you're not having a glass of wine with dinner. You're not having a beer as you're at the end of the day as you're relaxing and enjoying even translating. You're drunk. At that point, you're drinking for the purpose of being intoxicated. Now, I can tell you, I have been intoxicated probably half a dozen times in my life. The last time was in my early 20s, my mid-20s probably. I got to be honest, it was my late 20s the last time I was intoxicated. And but, you know, I'm in my 60s, so that was almost 40 years ago. And even the half a dozen times that I was intoxicated 40 to 50 years ago, I never drank to get drunk. Never once in my life have I consumed alcohol with the purpose of getting drunk. And I have never consumed alcohol as an escape. And I think that's what God's talking about here. Consuming alcohol to get drunk. Consuming alcohol just to cope as an escape mechanism. What follows is the kind of terminology you would expect in a song. These are musical instruments, all of them. And the musical instruments are being used to tell a story. So let's just go through the instruments here and see if we can figure out what story I was telling by them. It says the lyre, which is a kinnor, the zither, the large stringed instrument that when plucked makes a tremulous twanging sound and serves as a token of merriment. It's actually a Hittite loanword. The closest words would be kun to establish and kana, which is a flattering title for a shoot or branch which is transplanted. So the lyre from kinor would be from kina, which is a flattering title for a transplanted branch. You don't want to be a transplanted branch. You want to be a branch that's grafted into the vine that is just right.
Want to be removed.
No, I don't want to be removed. The harp. The harp is Neville. It's a guitar, portable, melodic, stringed instrument. But a harp, a Neville can just as easily be translated a vessel, bottle, or flask of skin that is used to transport wine. And, Kirk, you were checking into words. Nabal means to be foolish and senseless, to languish and fade away, to be immoral, vile, and a shameful corpse, a carcass associated with villainous idolatry.
Senseless, yeah, all those.
Yeah, and Nabala in the feminine is disgraceful and wicked, outrageous in defiance of the standard, a frivolous fool.
It says, you know, Nabal is associated, too, within a couple of letters, words over, and it's disgraced, fade away, sink or drop down, and diminished, lightly esteemed, and fall away.
Yeah, boy. So, you don't want to be a translated branch, and you don't want to be imbibing on the flask to the point that you're foolish and senseless. The third item on the list is the tambourine. It's a tof. It's a drum, a small percussion instrument, but it's also dangling earrings, usually hoops, round, circular things which had religious connotations as the sun god pendants, and jingling beads. Even the jeweled ornamentations on the headboard of a bed owned by the haughty and arrogant who flaunt their exaggerated sense of false pride. It's from tapoff, which is to play and to beat. You know, there's a lot of people throughout time, and Christianity had this really bad for a long time, particularly during the Dark Ages, who beat themselves.
Oh, yeah, they flogged themselves, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a whole sect of Islam, the Shiite sect of Islam, where on Ashura Day, they go and they beat themselves. You know, we have monks that burn themselves up alive and beat themselves to death. You know, what do you think a suicide bomber is doing?
Yeah. Dying, yeah.
Right. So these are the tof are the are signs of arrogance, and they're signs of frivolity, of signs of an affinity with the religious god, and of beating oneself up.
Congratulations.
Yeah, the next on the list is flute. It's Jalil. It's the pipe, reed, woodwind instrument, producing a shrill whistling sound. It is from Jalal. Jalal is a really bad word. When you read Jalal in the text, you need to duck, because it means to profane, to defile, to pollute, to violate, to wound, to slay, and to desecrate. Jalil is that which is forbidden and adversarial.
Ritually by contact of the dead as well.
Yeah. You know, the following the Pied Piper and people going along to their doom. You know, you got the flute of the early patriots in this country, in the revolutionaries. People have this tendency to follow the flute. You know, God is saying that this is something that is profane, defiled, polluted, wounded, slain, desecrated, forbidden, adversarial. Then he switches from the instruments to the wine. And the wine that is at their banquets, which are part of their feasts, festivals, and hedonistic events, where copious amounts...
It happened to be the wrong one.
Of alcohol is consumed. Because it's interesting, when Yahweh talks about a festival feast, he uses the term chag at the party, the mikra. Are chag, festival feast. This is, their banquets are mishteh. And he says that, you know, they've got the intoxicating beverage, the flute, which profanes, the tambourine, which is used to show one's arrogance, sun god affiliation, and to beat oneself, the harp, which is Neville, makes one foolish and senseless, languish and fade away, and the lyre, which is from Kana, a flattering title for a transplanted branch, all at their banquets. Not his banquets, their banquets. Hedonistic events where copious amounts of alcohol are consumed. Hey, you know, speaking of hedonistic events where copious amounts of alcohol are consumed, what's the most patriotic song in America?
God bless
What's
America?
The song that is being played when everybody is having a conniption fit whether or not NFL players ought to stand or can they? Star Spangled Banner. That's the one. You know the tune for the Star Spangled Banner? You know who wrote it? It wasn't Francis Scott Key. No, he wrote the lyrics to an existing song. You know who wrote the melody to that song?
It was a drunkard song, probably.
That song is worse than a drunkard song. You know, there's a lot of songs that are that we have in our country that were written as bar songs. No. This song was specifically conceived by a British society that was devoted to bringing back the celebration of pagan hedonism. Where sex and drunkenness would be celebrated as a divine right.
I miss
it
that.
It was a British society of individuals who specifically were trying to revitalize the pagan drunken prostitute ceremonies that were associated with the ancient religions, temple priestesses and alcoholic consumption. That's who wrote the
report. You're good, man.
This Star Spangled Banner.
Funny.
All right, but rewarding the work of Yahweh, they do not observe nor regard it, nor the work of his hands, neither seeing nor understanding. So they're really into their tambourine, their flute, their wine, their lyre. They're into all of that stuff. They're into their festivals and their Christmas, their Easter, their St. Valentine's Day, their St. Patrick's Day. By the way, major consumption of alcohol on those. Their Halloween. They're into their festival. But regarding the work of Yahweh, they don't regard it. They don't observe it. Nor the work of his hands, the things that he has personally done. They don't see it. They don't understand it. And that's the problem with Christmas and Easter. That's the problem with Halloween and St. Patrick's Day and Valentine's Day. The problem with Lent and all of these things is that by engaging in these things, the person just completely neglects what they were designed to cover up, what they were designed to negate. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I found it interesting here that Yahweh uses Yod. He could have used Kof. He could have used Kofof, which is the bend down, but that would be to bend down and bow. And then Kof, of course, is an open hand that gives pledges.
Mm-hmm.
How he, you know, but the simple fact that he's so precise, he uses Yod, which is a hand reaching down. The uplift is up. I mean,
right.
Everywhere you go, he's extraordinarily precise in this stuff. I mean, it's just, if you just look at it on the surface, you say, well, Kof is a hand. Why didn't he use Kof?
Well, he had actually used the hand in a very interesting way. I was between 5 and 6. Yahweh speaks of a different means of discipline. He's sort of in 5, he's really frustrated. He says, you know, they were so out of line, so unruly, so lost, self-absorbed in things that were self-destructive, that he said he turned his hand and slapped them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like you try to get somebody's attention, wake them up out of their stupor, stop doing this,
that's
you're going to kill yourself.
Yeah.
And then the second time, because there's, you know, that's one form of parenting. You know, if you have a really wayward child doing really destructive behavior, you want to slap some sense into them. And, you know, the other was a timeout. And the second time, you know, it says, you know, I'm just going to have nothing to do with them. For a very long time, I will have nothing to do with them. I'm going to leave them to themselves. I'm going to go away. They will hear nothing from me. I will hear nothing from them. You know, parenting changed. When I was a child, my father beat the living tar out of me with a tree branch. That was considered good parenting. And when our children were young, good parenting was the time out. Yahweh tried both with his children.
Neither one worked.
Neither one worked.
Some children also.
But he did try both. So, that takes us through the second stanza of Yahweh's open song. Now, as I've studied the human condition, I've come to the conclusion, and you know, my younger brother was mentally handicapped. I've witnessed a lot of people that are physically handicapped. And I've come to the conclusion, well, right or wrong, it's, you know, I guess we're all entitled to these kinds I hate to use the term entitled to an opinion, but we all derive our grand assessments of life. One of mine is that the most debilitating human condition is a bad attitude, and particularly a bad attitude that is fueled by ignorance. The most empowering, in my view, is understanding, particularly when it leads to a correct perspective on God. Now, with generations indoctrinated and incapacitated with political correctness due to the now to the point where they can no longer think for themselves, the preponderance of people are growing incapable of being discriminating. They can't differentiate between right and wrong. Therefore, this is where we find ourselves. Now, here's a Iowa statement in 513. As a consequence, lock-in, as a result, therefore, it follows that my people, Amani, are exposed and vulnerable. Galah are revealed for who they really are. They're laid bare. They're stripped of any pretense. They're exiled, many as captives, because of their lack of knowledge and discernment. Bale Dayat, their failure to comprehend, their lack of apprehension, their ignorance and inability to understand, their incapacity to distinguish between right and wrong, their unwillingness to discriminate between good and bad, their reluctance to differentiate between truth and lies. Dayat is from Yada, to know, to acknowledge, to learn, to discriminate, to recognize, and to understand. They honor and attribute high status to Kabud. They respect the reputation and the abundance, the popularity and the manifestation of power, the overall societal acceptance of their ravenous and insatiable, their voracious maggots of men, lowly and insignificant humans. So their capacity for compassion and ability to enrich has shriveled up and evaporated. Well, what do you think about them apples?
Well, yeah.
So the first part of the show
is pretty damning and pretty descriptive of the vast majority of the people in the world today.
Yeah, it is. People today are vulnerable. They're easily misled into conspiracy, fake news, religion, politics, patriotism. So they're exposed, they're vulnerable, they're laid bare for one reason, because of their lack of knowledge and discernment.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Why we've been having this whole discussion at this point. That's the most debilitating thing in the universe.
But when you go on to say, and I don't want to tip the hand of what you're saying, but when you're talking about why Christianity and Paul got a foothold, why it couldn't have lasted if anybody had a brain or anybody knew anything, and just as
right.
bad for the rabbis what they did to the Yehudim and Israel, because they didn't know any better. If you don't study the Torah, if you don't know anything, and you can't relate it to anything. So they just sit there and say, even if they knew a little bit, they're not equipped to compete. But I like what you were saying about Paul. You know, he couldn't get a foothold with Shimon Kepesh and them because they knew.
Right.
And then these weren't the most educated men, but they knew Yahweh, and they walked around with Yahusha for 3 years, and what the Torah said, and they couldn't get a foothold there. He could only get it in. These other places. So it's how tragic. And all just because nobody studied it.
Yeah.
It's right there in the middle of their main city.
Because people are ignorant and irrational.
I think they just don't have the want to either. I don't know
why. Well,
I do.
I agree.
I know they don't have... They just don't care. And that's an attitude problem. Yeah.
Now, the next part of this is that this is the nature of politics, also the nature of religion. I mean, if the Pope goes to a foreign city, millions of people will show up, and they'll swoon at his feet. If Donald Trump goes to a rally, thousands of people will show up, and they'll hold signs, you know, MAGA, make America great again. And when you are stupid, that's another word for ignorant and irrational. When you are stupid, you have a tendency to honor and attribute high status to maggots of men, the lowly and insignificant parasitic louses. And that describes almost everybody in politics the world over. Almost everybody in religion the world over. They're maggots feeding on decaying flesh. They're louses. And we're going to speak to how those terms are derived and what they imply. But that's our problem, is that by being ignorant and irrational, people believe Paul. If you shed your ignorance, if you use just a touch of logic, it's immediately obvious that it was a complete and utter fraud, and that Christianity dies with him. But God's being really insightful here. As a result of being ignorant and irrational, the inability to be discerning, irrational, people honor and attribute high status to ravenous and insatiable maggots of men. Now, we'll speak about how I came up with maggots of men and louses, parasitic and voracious, walking dead. This would be kind of like the zombies. But why do you think it says their capacity for compassion and ability to enrich has shriveled up and evaporated? Our capacity to enrich is directly derived from our knowledge and understanding of who Yahweh is and what he's offering.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one meaningful way to empower and enrich another life, and that is to invite people to consider Yahweh's Torah as it presents the terms and conditions of the covenant. And if you are ignorant of that, if you're irrational and you don't understand how that works and why it exists the way it does, you have no capacity to do anything that's of any value to anybody, particularly when it comes to meaningful empowerment and enrichment. Shriveled up and evaporated. Of course, the beginning of this is very much like, my people are destroyed because they're ignorant and irrational. That's the line in the chapter of Hosea. But the gist of this is that the most debilitating and deadly consequence of ignorance is the tendency of misled individuals to ascribe status to men. You know, if you look at Fred having gone off the deep end into the abyss, he was listening to idiots on videos. And they're just absolute nincompoops. But he lost the ability to be able to discern, why he shouldn't be listening to these nuts. You know, the guys with unpopular truth, they believed nincompoops. Every one of their conspiracies was advanced by people who just weren't even remotely credible. And this is the problem, that if you're ignorant and irrational, you're prone to believe people that are foolish. You're prone to believe and ascribe status to men, particularly popes, pastors, and politicians. The ignorant don't know they're being lied to. They don't know they're being taken advantage of. They don't know they're being fleeced. And they will foolishly pronounce their loyalty and make donations to those without compunction who rob them.
If that were not so, then how could you now support a president after 15 years of fruitless war and draining your money, killing your children, and killing millions of people, and allowing millions of people to die because of the consequence of you killing off a whole bunch of people like in Iraq?
Correct.
And then the first year in office, he's setting all up to go to war again, to extend the war in Afghanistan. And and God knows what they're going to do with North Korea, you know.
Yeah.
When is this
end? The world lost, they've recalibrated the numbers because of what happened in many countries where it wasn't until very recently we knew really the consequence of World War II. But 80 million people died in World War II, and 100 million people died in the immediate aftermath of World War II because of the way that World War II reshaped the world, giving power to the likes of Mao Zedong and Stalin. Mm-hmm. And they were worse than the evil that was eliminated in Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany. And that's saying a lot because Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany were extraordinarily evil. But we consider the generation that fought that war, like in America, but also in Russia, where, you know, in Russia it was like 10 million soldiers were sacrificed. And then the United States, 400,000 were sacrificed to avenge the death of 3,000. Unbelievably stupid the way that we prosecuted the war. And I've been in a discussion with Roy, and he thinks that that there is some good that was done by the United States involvement in World War II. And we've had a lively debate on the merits of the U.S. involvement. The fact is, to honor those individuals that made such a mess of things, and the patriotism that grew out of that, and consequently, and my biggest concern is that out of World War II was born the New Rome. Out of World War II was born a tremendous and belligerent beast. Out of World War II was born the country that Yahweh issues the warning to in Yeshaya 18, the United States. Mm-hmm. The most militaristic nation in the history of the world. The most imposing nation in the history of the world. We ought not have done that. And somewhere along the way, somebody said, you know, what we did was grotesquely irrational. You don't celebrate sacrificing 400,000 lives to avenge the deaths of 3,000. It is interesting in this particular passage that none of the normal Hebrew words for man were used. You know, we're talking about these lowly individuals that I refer to as maggots and as louses. Well, the normal common Hebrew word for man, Adam, which would be descendants of Adam, Ish, which are individuals, that's probably the most common, Enosh, which is mortal man, and Geber, which is political, militant, strong men. Those are the four: Adam, Ish, Enosh, and Geber. But that's not the term that Yahweh used. He used the least prevalent, which is moth. It is therefore prudent to ascertain why he selected it over the more prominent options. At first blush, we discovered that it was considered to be less masculine in nature than either Adam or Ish, and thus can be translated person or people, human or human beings. This is revealing because God is contrasting his plan with the schemes promoted by humankind. Now, second, moth is typically used to describe a very small number of people. When you look at its use in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, it describes a very small number of people. It literally means men who can be numbered, as opposed to innumerable individuals. So it sometimes it's just translated very few. Now, I thought that was telling, because while relatively few men have claimed to speak for God, only a handful have started a new religion and authored its scriptures as an apostle or prophet.
Or at least had success with it.
Yes. And if they didn't have any success, it would never have mentioned.
They don't matter.
Never brought
they
it
don't
up.
Matter. That's right. Third, moth is the opposite of Gibor. Gabor means mighty warriors and political leaders, and speaks of someone who is considered to be someone who is considered to be lowly and little, even insignificant. Is that the ring of chime?
Hello.
While Shaul was Paul's given name, he not only chose the Roman moniker, Paulos, means lowly and little in Latin. Yosha revealed during his instructional amount that heaven's name for the individual attempting to annul the Torah would be Paulos, lowly and little. Fourth, according to the Dictionary of Biblical Languages, and a week ago, you had said that...
Yes, I know this was for me. I appreciate this, too. I read it.
Yeah, I did it really for both of us, you know.
Thank you very much.
Find something that doesn't concur with the research that I've done on these words.
I found a lot of it, even though I haven't got my books yet.
I wanted to look at that as a challenge. You took it the right way. You brought something up, and we were trying to discern. Well, is that really a reasonable way to go? And so, I spent part of a day searching everything that I could learn about the Hebrew word mom. Now, we shared with you, I think, Kirk, JB, and I, that our favorite lexicon, because of the way that it presents terms in terms of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in terms of preferred meanings, the fact that it has the least influence of religiosity, it doesn't exist to prove any translation correct. So it is just the way that it is formatted, the way that it presents words. Now, it has its liabilities. I don't like the way it transliterates words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't differentiate between the thin and the shin, for example, S or SH. It renders the cough as an S rather than the C. So I don't like the way it transliterates words. It always eliminates the O if the O is the reason for the vowel sound. It does not show you any reason or justification for the A or the E sound of the LF or AIM. So I don't like its transliterations.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes no attempt to define a root. But, you know, we're not looking for things that are...
I really wish they did that.
Yeah, these are just tools. Right? So they're just tools. But that's our... JB, that's my favorite tool. I think it's your favorite tool of the tools in our arsenal.
Oh, yeah.
So,
it's my go-to first one.
It's the first one I go to 100% of the time. The second one I go to is Strong's. I go to Strong's for transliteration. I go to Strong's for roots. And then I go to the Theological Word Book.
Yep.
Because the Theological Word Book has several things that I really like. It's got some things I really hate. For example, it brings up Arabic as if Arabic mattered.
If Arabic came before Hebrew and the Hebrew word was derived from Arabic, I'm like, really? Come on.
Yeah. Written Hebrew is 6,000 years old. Written Arabic is a derivative of Hebrew, uses the Hebrew alphabet. Words like Quran are from the Hebrew kara. And written Arabic didn't come to exist until around 700 to 750 CE, which is more than 3,000 years after we have the Torah written in Hebrew. No, I don't care what the Arabic says. And there's a lot of religiosity into it, but they do a good job of showing how the meaning of various words is affected by the stems, and it does a really good job of showing where the words were used and what meaning is attributed to the word in each of those specific cases.
And also does a good job of kind of showing you how a word was derived from its root. You get a lot of that in there, and I really appreciate that aspect.
Yeah, I agree too. So it's the go-to, third on the list. I need to do some more thinkology on this word. So we're now with a dictionary on biblical languages, Hebrew. That's our first. And when we look up moth there, it says that it can be translated louse. A louse is the singular of lice.
Mm-hmm.
It is a small parasitic insect that lives by sucking the lifeblood of warm-blooded creatures, or it can be translated a maggot. Lice are obligate parasites, meaning that they are incapable of reproducing without exploiting a suitable creature. That's just like religion. They invade their victims by modifying their chemical signature to match that of their hosts. That's Paul, you know, to the Torah observing, I was Torah observing, even though I wasn't. To the Torahless, I was Torahless. To the Gentile, I was a Gentile. To the Jew, I was a Jew. I was whatever my audience wanted me to be so I could take advantage of them.
All things to all men.
Louse is a perfect depiction of Paul. Modifying their chemical...
Oh, just religion in general. Look at how Christianity took on the aspects of the pagan religions.
Correct.
And the countries it invaded.
It did indeed. It says of lice that they are vectors of disease, of course, Christianity, the plague of death, such as typhus, transmitting infectious, debilitating, and deadly pathogens to other living organisms. Paul was a disease-spreading, parasitic bloodsucker who mimicked the racial, political, and religious makeup of his audience to more readily exploit them. While considering the commonality between Paul and lice, I found, by the way, another interesting connection. Considering the fact that yeast is removed on matzah, unyeasted bread, to perfect the loaf by removing the fungus of sin, in particular, religion, fungi, such as yeast, serve as a host and conduit of disease, with weeds preventing or providing a safe harbor to vector viruses. So I had no idea of the role of fungi, and of course yeast is fungi, and the plant kingdom of transmitting disease. But according to everything that I read as I was studying lice, and particularly vectors of disease, the first thing you learn is that, well, fungi is a very effective transmitter of disease, particularly in conjunction with weeds, which is something that Yahweh says equates to religion. Now, a maggot is the larva of a fly. It is a footless, worm-like creature which feeds off living tissue, animal excrement, decaying carcasses, and foul food. Like a louse, it is prone to spread microbial infectious diseases. Humans are not immune to the feeding habits of maggots and can contract disease by approaching garbage or dead animals or rotten food infected with maggots, all of which are symbolic of things Yahweh encourages us to avoid. Like religion, maggot infestation grows exponentially if not checked. In this vein, moth is used to describe the disreputable or the disadvantaged. In Yeshayah, Isaiah 41:14, for example, the remnant of Israelite men are depicted as if they were puny lice or worms. In Mizmor Psalm 26:4, Doe disassociates himself from the moth, who he claims are incompetent, invalid, and vain. Moth is used in Job 11:11 and 22:15 to describe men who are evil, wicked, and egotistical. Yahweh was still pointing his finger directly at Shaul, Paul. Now, the fifth thing I learned is that meth, written exactly the same way, is vocalized differently, but written identically in the Hebrew text, means corpse. It is the carcass of a dead body, and thus indicative of death. Yahweh routinely refers to Shaul as the plague of death. Sixth, moth ben is a combination, a compound, if you will, of moth and ben's son, as it is defined as chaff or straw that is dried up and then cast or blown away. This infers that the moth are offspring of castaways. And finally, metheg is the bridle for a donkey, including a bit as a mouthpiece and reins for leading it. Boy, that speaks of religion, too.
Yeah.
Now, if we were to expand moth's reach beyond a lone individual and thus beyond the few people it typically addresses, and therefore past Paul, many of the world's leaders, both religious and political, are parasitic maggots and lowly louses. They are counterproductive and destructive, deceitful and deadly, and thus ultimately damning. Promising to enrich their greedy supporters to gain popularity and garner votes, they rob the relatively few who are rich to appease the multitude who are poor. By redistributing wealth rather than creating it, the economy shrivels and the nation's abundance evaporates. Just as Yahweh is warning and lamenting here in the prophecy. While it may be politically expedient to punish success and reward failure because it is deemed politically correct among those infected with the immoral and irrational socialist mindset, it is a bankrupt policy. That was my research on moth. Kirk?
It was brilliant. I mean, brilliant. I did some little homework, and this is obviously not the scope that you just described, but I did find in ancient Hebrew a man who worships is a man who is a worshiper of Astarte, a man of Baal, defective
yeah,
man.
Good.
No, man of false.
Worshiper of Astarte
would
be a Christian in today's parlance, by the way.
Yes, I thought, yeah, Easter.
Yeah.
I found to suck out, to wring out, to be wrung out, and then also to be sucked out empty from hunger and from shathah, which is muff, which is to drink water, wine, milk, or to blood. So, I mean, I got around it.
Well, the Catholic
Church wasn't true.
Like
I just didn't have a reference to go to, so I need a couple more books, apparently, to, every now and then I run across a word like that, but I appreciate that, truly. I thought that was wonderful when I read it. I said, cool.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
I don't think people appreciate, this is an opportunity for me to say something, people don't appreciate how thorough these translations are and how much work goes into them. I mean, I think I work pretty hard sometimes just trying to put them all down, not to write the way you guys write them. But I can obviously figure out through researching each one of the words what all these things mean, and it is true that you just can't get around this stuff. This is as good a translation as I can find anywhere in what you do. I mean,
I think there's really three aspects of that are fun about them. I don't view them really as work, although I think work is a good thing. I think work is a fun, enabling, productive
thing. Not a dirty word.
So from my understanding of the word work, it is work, but I only look at work as a highly positive, value-added, rewarding thing. But the three benefits, the three things that are most enjoyable is, first, the translation itself. Can you figure out what God is saying?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's really easy, and sometimes it's really hard.
Sure. Yeah.
Sometimes it is work. And sometimes it just, you know, falls into place. And the times that it's really hard are always the most interesting. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to dig into the etymology of the words. That's moth here. And figure out everything that they could convey, because I have found, typically, that if a word can convey multiple meanings, God intended all of them. We're going to come to a word in the sixth chapter of Yahshua, a pair of words. And there are four very distinct meanings with each of the four. And it was just the most interesting thing this morning as I was working on them. If you take each of the four in the order of relevance, you know, because we talked about the Dictionary of Biblical Languages, Hebrew, that being our favorite. One of the things it does, JB, is it lists this is number one meaning, number two meaning, number three meaning, number four meaning of each word.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the two words that were juxtaposed, and I wrote the top four meanings of the first word and the top four meanings of the second word. And by the way, these meanings were really divergent. And then what I did is I put the first meaning with the first meaning of the second, of the first word with the first meaning of the second word, and on down the line, second meaning with second meaning. And all of a sudden I had four extraordinarily revealing concepts, all just laid out, all of which were relevant, all of which provided a unique insight into what God was saying. And so, as I say, the third part of the second part of the fun is really getting in depth with an individual word. And I think the thing that is the most fun, the third aspect, is once you've translated and you understand what God is trying to say, and then you've gone into depth and derived as much meaning from each word as is possible, amplified its meaning. Because I'm not smart enough to limit what God said to one of the possibilities. I'm just not going to do that. I'm not smart enough to decide which one God meant, if there are several that apply. But the thing that then is the most fun of all is the insights. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now that we know what he said, we know what these words can mean and convey, how does that apply to us? How does that apply to our lives? What is it telling us that's useful and important for us to know? The insights. That's the one, two, and three of the process that makes it, I'd say, addictive. I'm passionate about it. I'm addicted to it. It's every day. It's this opportunity to connect the dots, lay out more pieces and connect them within the puzzle. It's good stuff. That's why, by the way, I do think that when we get to the end of this verse, I think he's talking about us.
I did three pages on 5:26. He's absolutely talking about this. What's happening?
Yeah, I think.
And
he
no question in my mind.
Not in mine either. And we're not going to say that. There's no ego associated with that.
No.
He's talking about us by default. He's talking about us by default. It's just that no one else was interested. No, we're not, absolutely we're not first choice. In fact, I don't even think we were the choice.
No. But I'm glad you chose, and I chose to listen.
Strictly by default. No one else was interested.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's not exclusive, although it speaks of a single banner and a single individual, ultimately, that was responsible for doing this, and that became we, but it began as a he. It's singular. It's still not exclusive.
No. Anybody can pick up the Torah and read it.
That's exactly right. Later. You know, I know that the 91st Psalm applies to me. But it applies to you guys, too. You know, there's a lot of things that are individual that can apply to many of us who are part of the covenant family and to all of us that are part of the covenant family. It doesn't change its individual benefit. You know, for example, we're individually adopted. We're individually perfected. We're individually immortalized. But just because I've been adopted, perfected, and immortalized, enriched, and empowered, doesn't preclude anyone else from getting the same benefits.
No.
That's the same thing is true with this banner. It would be lovely. It would be extraordinary. It would be exciting to have somebody else do the same thing and have Yahweh lift that banner up. We're not in competition.
No.
There are different ways to look at Hamon in this concept, which is the end result. You know, they're no longer able to enrich and empower. Yahweh could be addressing the economic failures of democracy, whereby the tyranny of the majority robs the minority under the approving applause of popular politicians promoting progressive taxation and entitlements. It is a pack of wolves and a lone lamb voting on who to eat for dinner. Or he could be saying something more profound, predicting that when a relationship with him through the Torah, especially through its Beireth and Mikre, is replaced by religion and ignorance and misplaced trust, beguiles the population into depending upon their government rather than on God. The benefits that Yahweh has provided through Yahudim and Jerusalem are forestalled. I think it's the second, primarily. When the chosen people, but the first is still there. You know, Yahweh specifically said of Yisrael, you know, if you listen to what I have to say, and you know, and you respond appropriately, you're going to be the richest people on earth. You're going to be the most powerful people on earth. You're going to be the envy of the world if you just listen to what I say. So, you know, part of it is, yes, riches in this world, however temporal they may be. But the big issue is always, and enriching Israel in the here and now, had they listened to him, was only to convey them as a symbol of the enrichment that we inherit when we eternally, when we're part of the covenant. So they are related. One is a sign of the other, and the impoverishment is a sign of one, a sign of the other. When the chosen people fail to comprehend what Yahweh has said and done, their capacity to convey his compassion through the Mikre and their ability to enrich through the Beireth covenant evaporates. That's what Paul destroyed with Christianity. It is then what Akiba caused to shrivel even further with Rabbinic Judaism, with his treasonous Talmud and false Matziah, leading to the Diaspora and the unrelenting persecution under Rome. Now, as we continue to progress and process the consequence of political and religious ignorance and consider how the lack of discernment provides the opportunity for evil individuals to rob people of their wealth and possessions, their freedoms and opportunities, and especially their relationship with God and their salvation, Yahweh is now prepared to turn our attention to the worst of these men, to the epitome of a louse, to the living embodiment of a maggot, to Satan's most popular and esteemed ambassador, to Shaul, known to Christians as Paul. Even his assumed Roman name, Paulos, identifies him as the lowly and little subject of this indictment. Shaul, Paul, robbed billions of Christians of their souls, stealing their inheritance, the possibility of eternal life in the covenant. Now, in this light, it is incumbent upon us to acknowledge that Sheol, the lightless and eternal prison for souls who have been condemned by God, and Shaul, the principal author of the Christian New Testament, are indistinguishable in the Hebrew text. Now, don't you think there would have been a theologian along the way who would have said, hey, folks, maybe that's a problem.
This is interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I ought to look at the times that Sheol is mentioned and Sheol is personified, because then God would be talking about Shaul. If he's talking about Sheol, then we have either an affirmation that his letters were inspired, or we have a condemnation against him.
Yeah.
But that would be too rational, wouldn't it?
Well, why is it, and you've discussed this many times, why is it when you look at something like this and it's talking about a mouth or a soul, a nephesh, I know they don't translate it as nephesh in the English Bibles. You know that, right? That's right. And yeah. There is no, and for some reason, parape becomes
feminine gender. In this passage, nephesh becomes appetite in Christian Bible.
Yeah, or something. I forget what I looked at, but it was that's not nephesh.
No,
Sheol is the place of separation,
right.
Black hole.
Right.
It has none of those attributes. So why would somebody that was translating not think, wait a minute, this can't be the place. It's got to be a name.
Right. Yeah, in fact, in a Chabaouk reference where every aspect of Paul's life and his nature and his influence on Christianity are delineated, even the timing, 666 years before he'd write his first letter, are listed out. It says the soul of Shaul. And he wanted to know, I'm talking about a man.
Yeah.
Places don't have souls.
How plain can you be?
Men do. So the soul of a man named Shaul is the plague of death. Yeah, and here they will do everything to keep it from being presented as soul. Now, so that you know, soul and consciousness are the same concept. It is animal consciousness that is the nature of a soul. It's what gives an animal, and humans are animals, the ability to observe and respond to their environment. A tree, a weed, cannot observe and respond to the environment. An animal can.
You drive a bulldozer on a tree, it's going to stay there, and you're going to run it over. You drive it on an animal, it's going to run out the way.
That is correct. That is the difference. Exactly. That is the difference. And so it is a soul, it's consciousness. So here, as it is in Chabaouk, and by the way, we're not broadcast anymore, we're still recording, and I'd like to go ahead and finish this statement since we're well into setting it up. So here, as it is in Chabaouk, in the second chapter, the presence of a nephesh soul immediately following the name affirms that Yashayah heard Yahweh say Shaul, thereby excluding Sheol from consideration. This is therefore a direct and unambiguous condemnation of Pauline Christianity, its New Testament, and replacement theology, in addition to Roman Catholicism and salvation through grace. Here's what it says. As a result, Lacan, therefore, as a consequence, it follows that there is an enormous opportunity. There is a wide open, broadened, and enlarged opening for the improper and greedy boasts of Shaul's soul. And so he has opened his mouth to speak beyond measure without thinking. So then the status, productive nature, and outstanding aspects of Jerusalem will decline and be abandoned, along with her capacity for compassion, in addition to those joyously reveling and celebrating in her. Yashayah, salvation is from Yah, Isaiah 5:14. They say, how do you like them apples?
I do. Recall there's a wide path.
Yeah, I know.
Narrow path and wide path.
Yeah, are you familiar with a little section where Yosha destroys Paul's credibility in his first public discourse in the Instruction on the Mount? And he says that the broad path leads to
death and destruction.
Right, death and destruction. You know, I'm of the conclusion, the more I read the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the Torah, Nabi, and Mizmor, that there isn't a single thing Yosha says that can't be found in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. That's not a criticism of him. That is actually a celebration of him. You know, because
Yahweh would say, he would speak my words.
Right, he would be my mouth, he would speak my words. That's exactly what he's doing. And so the condemnation of the lowly and little one during the Instruction on the Mount specifically says the path that leads to death is broad. It's popular. It's exactly the term that was used here in Hebrew. As a matter of fact, I can assure you that rather than the Greek word that underlined it in our English translations, when he was saying to speak, when he was actually delivering the Instruction on the Mount, he used the Hebrew word. He used rakab. He said rakab. As a result, there is an enormous opportunity. There is a wide open, broadened, and enlarged opening for the improper and greedy boast of Shaul's soul. Yeah, you affirm this in the Instruction on the Mount. Read Matanyah 5. He has opened his mouth to speak, parted his lips to impart words beyond measure and without thinking, for the purpose of negating the word without ceasing through corrupt inscribed decrees and invalid conditions for living. La Mali Choke. Wow.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I mean, you just you sit there on something that seems straightforward enough, and then you go, oh, wow. That's just a lot of wowies.
Yes, a lot of wows. This is a profound statement, and God is speaking specifically to Paul. Now, you might say, well, why would he say after this that the status, the productive nature, the outstanding aspects of Jerusalem were declined and abandoned?
Well, of course, nobody's going to promote the Torah if you wipe everybody out.
Where did everything happen that is relevant to knowing and engaging in a relationship with Yahweh?
Jerusalem, or in the center
where,
of Israel?
Where did when Yahweh took on human form and he decided he would fulfill his mikra, where did he do it?
Jerusalem.
What does Jerusalem mean in Hebrew? It's a compound of two words.
It's reconciliation.
It's Yara, which is the basis of the verb that underlies the word Torah.
Yeah.
And Shalom. Torah, Yara, the verb, means source from which guidance, direction, instruction, and teaching flow. And Shalom means reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jerusalem is the source from which teaching, guidance, instruction, and direction regarding reconciliation flows. Paul negated everything in Jerusalem. His first meeting in Jerusalem was to negate everything. His religion is conceived in Damascus. And he only went to Jerusalem to destroy its credibility.
Yeah.
Correct. And so with Pauline Christianity, the Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shavuah, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah are not only not celebrated, not observed, and therefore there's no benefits derived from them, they are presented as the Torah is presented, as circumcision, which is the sign of the covenant, is presented as a liability. If you are Torah observant, you cannot be saved. If you choose to observe the invitations to meet with God, you cannot be saved. If you're circumcised, you cannot be saved. And so what Paul did in Jerusalem was to undermine the Torah's ability to provide that source of reconciliation.
Well, I would add to your list also Zion in the middle of Jerusalem too, in the city of David,
of
all the signs along the way.
Where did Paul, with his book of Romans, replace Jerusalem and Yehuda with?
Rome.
Rome. What a disgusting thing to do. So he negated the benefits of Jerusalem by replacing it with Rome. And therefore,
the capacity
for compassion, for abundance, for mercy, to enrich, to benefit those who would observe the Torah as it flows out of Jerusalem, gone. And there's no one reveling or celebrating the Mikre in her anymore.
Well, you're very poignant. Later you'll say, which I thought was really on the mark, they wouldn't stand up for the Torah because of lack of knowledge, but also basically they didn't have any backbone. They didn't care.
No backbone.
I mean, it wasn't important enough for them.
Yeah. The reason Paul succeeded is because Yahudim failed.
Yeah.
That's the reason he succeeded. They failed.
Yeah. That's why Islam succeeded.
That's right. Islam succeeded because Yehudim, in fact, in that case, it's more probably Yisrael, failed.
Mm-hmm.
Had Yisrael and Yehudim made the effort, by the way, I want to interrupt this program for an announcement. I don't know if you had a chance to read what, I think it was Chuck that sent it to us, the article on the Bula found in Jerusalem. Did you read that?
I think I got that one.
Pardon?
Is that all the...
Just in the last week, there have been unearthed in Jerusalem an enormous cache of Bula. Those are the little signature things.
The thing you do your letter.
Right.
Yes.
And there are scores of Yisraelite Bula in Jerusalem. And the date is... The date is immediately after the Assyrians destroyed the Northern Kingdom, Israel.
Yeah.
And so many of the Israelites, Ephraim of the 10 tribes, fled to and lived in Yehuda.
What was interesting is they got to be quite prominent there as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Interesting to me.
Yeah. So I thought that was, they were accepted and lived in Yehuda.
And you sold out all the real
things? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so it's now Yisrael and Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
Have they made the effort to observe Yahweh's Torah instead of the Rabbinic Talmud? Have they engaged in Yahweh's covenant instead of becoming overtly religious? Had they called God by his name? The majority of people would have been too familiar with Yahweh's testimony and promises for Shaul to succeed. Sure. His absurd pro-government stance would have appealed to Romans, and his appalling Gnostic approach would have resonated with Greeks. But it wouldn't have lasted. And the reason should have been obvious, because Paul, like Muhammad after him, wasn't sufficiently creative or credible to create a religion which could stand on its own merits. Paul, like Muhammad, usurped the Torah's credibility. They were deliberately inaccurate plagiarizers and careless counterfeiters. Now, it's obvious that Gentiles weren't just wholly ignorant of the Torah. They were put off by it, since they believed that their political and religious ideas were far more civilized and progressive. Moreover, it's not just that Romans disrespected Yahudim. They despised them for having the audacity to rebel against them. This disdain for Yahweh's chosen people created an audience that were predisposed to accept Paul's anti-Semitic rant. But accepting and believing words apart. So, or excuse me, I should say accepting and believing are worlds apart. So, for the new religion of Pauline Christianity to take root and garner thousands and then millions and billions of believers, its authenticity would have to have come from the testimony it contradicted, because the Torah and prophets provided the lone credible witness regarding God. This blending of truth and lies was achieved simply because those who should have known better didn't. The chosen people neither understood the purpose of the Torah nor its association with Yahusha. They did not even know its name, or the name of the God in whose name he had come.
Well, that's a mouthful.
Cool. But that is the problem. They did not know the name of the God in whose name he had come. They did not know Yahusha's association with the Torah. And therefore, none of them stood up to contradict Paul. They thought Paul was, authoring that new religion. The Bible is the result of this babble, intermixing of God's word with man's words. Paul was able to fool Romans and Greeks because Yahudim were unable and unwilling to take a stand on behalf of their God. They did not and could not expose and condemn their enemies, nor his enemies, as Dodd had done. They hadn't just stopped cultivating and pruning Yahweh's vineyard. They had forgotten it even existed. Everything that God had accomplished on Moriah through his Mikre and Mereth would be for naught. Yahweh, as is his approach in nature, revealed exactly what would happen and then explained why it would occur. The very reason that Christianity exists today, the only reason that Shaul prevailed, is as simple as 1, 2, 3. First, my people became exposed and vulnerable because of their lack of knowledge and discernment. This is what made them susceptible to being misled. Lying and self-serving religious and political aspirants can only fool fools. And once fooled, they didn't know how to refute the charlatan in their midst. Unchallenged, the most absurd compilation of twisted logic and misquotations became the religion of politics and thereby impervious to evidence and reason. In an environment where no one knew any better, it no longer mattered that Paul's proposition was preposterous. Second, they attributed high status to their ravenous and insatiable maggots of men, to lowly and little parasitic louses. So their capacity for compassion and ability to enrich evaporated. As is the case with Orthodox Jews, Christians, and Muslims, their deceitful and destructive dogmas grow in popularity because, not knowing the Torah prophets, the faithful are beguiled into believing those who say that their religion is legitimized by them. Even though all three beliefs are condemned by the Torah, the people's collective ignorance of this reality creates the opportunity for religious malfeasance. The masses are beguiled into believing that God is on their side, when in actuality, he's opposed to them. Ultimately, these three faiths have incapacitated every believer's ability to resolve the problem of having transformed maggots into messengers. Unable or unwilling to refute them, the lowly louses are afforded the highest possible status. Religion, or reason, I should say, is the first casualty of faith. False prophets prevail when no one knows the truth. The worst of men, these parasites, are called apostle, saint, holy father, prophet, and messenger of God. The testimony of such men is believed over the message that God himself conveyed, and yet they claim that the God who inspired them was subject to being contradicted by them. How is it that the testimony of a man can be believed over that of God, over the same God they claimed inspired them, when they contradict him? Folks, it is institutionalized insanity. And in these asylums, there is no compassion. Rather than enriching and empowering humankind, as God is desirous of doing, the individuals who lead the resulting political and religious institutions are enriched and empowered by depriving the preponderance of people of their opportunity to know it. Here's the third step. As a result, there is an enormous opportunity, a wide open, broadened, and enlarged opening for the improper and greedy boasts of Shaul's soul and human desires. And so he has opened his mouth to speak beyond measure and without thinking for the purpose of negating the word through corrupt inscribed decrees and invalid conditions for living. While Paul bragged about being Gamaliel's most acclaimed student, he was, by his own admission, a rabbinic school dropout. He consistently misquoted the Torah and prophets and continually contradicted himself. his every argument on behalf of his religion was rife with fallacies. In many cases, his protestations were so preposterous, the opposite of what he claimed was true. It would have been extraordinarily easy to refute him and stop his plague of death from infecting the planet had it been done early on by a significant representation of the chosen people. Yoshai, in his most effusive and comprehensive denunciation of Paul and his religion, reiterated this prediction. He specifically stated during his declaration on the Mount that this broad way within an enlarged opening would lead to the death and destruction of countless souls. The lives of those who would find Paul's gospel appealing, who wrongly believed that he had somehow made the Torah obsolete, would be snuffed out, evaporating away. Had the truth been conveyed at the right time by the right people, Christianity would never have been able to add the Old Testament, that in quotes, to their New Testament, and join these opposites together in their Bible. And without the Word of God, the Torah, Nabi, and Mizmor, the result would have been an incredulous blend of one very poorly translated eyewitness biography, Matthew, two poorly retained and translated books by Yohanan, John and Revelation, several hearsay accounts, some letters of spurious authorship, and Paul's 13 epistles, all of which were deceitful, destructive, and deadly. The resulting tome of contradictions wouldn't have fooled anyone. If you read Paul's letters, this realization is obvious. Everyone rejected him. Read his second letter to Timothy, his lover. Everyone rejected him. But unfortunately, apart from Shimon, very few, if any, of those who were opposed to Paul left a written legacy as to why his epistles ought to be discarded. Either that, or Imperial Rome and the Roman Catholic Church destroyed their testimony. As a result, Paul's inscribed decrees negating the word were immeasurably more prolific than those exposing and condemning him. He won the war of words simply by writing more words. Ultimately, no one made the case against Paul. There are a few denunciations from Shimon, but his statements were overly polite and woefully insufficient. Jacob didn't name his foe in his letter while refuting Paul's appalling notion of salvation through faith. He lacked specificity. If only someone had written questioning Paul 2,000 years ago, refuting Paul by comparing his testimony to God's, 10 billion souls may have been inoculated against the plague of death. But there was no one willing to do so. Stupefied by their Talmud, deceived by the maggots of men who promoted it, religious Jews were either not interested nor incapable of explaining why Shaul's corruption of Yahusha's message was dead wrong. Therefore, the counterfeit portrayal of God he drew took root and grew, choking out the vineyard Yahweh had planted and Dod had tended. Had Dod been alive at the time, he would have taken him to task. For the better part of 2,000 years, there would be no trace of his vines as the weeds of religion thrived in their place. In the aftermath of Shaul's contentious meeting with Yahusha's disciples Shimon and Jacob in Jerusalem in 50 CE, and Paul's subsequent and irrational anti-Semitic and ungodly rebuttal in his letters to the Galatians, Rome, whom Paul served, would sack the city twice, destroying the temple while burning almost every copy of the Torah. A multitude were killed. Even more were hauled off as slaves. the source of guidance on reconciliation shriveled, and with it, God's means to compassion and enrichment. Becoming the living embodiment of Yahweh's promise to curse those who cursed his people, Paul died in exile, deprived of his freedom, friendless and alone, having been rejected by everyone he had known. Even his captor and beneficiary, Rome, the most powerful empire the world had ever known, would shrivel up and die soon thereafter. They'd be plagued by one lowly and little louse of a man after another, as the likes of Tiberius and Hadrian, Claudius and Caligula, Nero and Thrax, Domitian and Diocletian, Commodus and Elagabus, Honorius and Caracalla, Severinus and Valerian, Constantine and Theodosius, sought to be God, sought to be general and emperor. They would soon suffer under those they had abused, the Romans reveling in triumph in 70 CE and 135, would fade into oblivion. Their decline from the height of their power from that date forward was precipitous and unmitigated. It is what God foretold. It is what happened. Jonah, I'm sorry for talking that long, but a lot of thoughts.
I enjoyed every second of it. So
yes, indeed.
This was one of the most profound experiences of my life, was encountering what God had to say in Yeshayah 5. So if I come across a little too wordy and too passionate, this really struck me.
I'm glad we jumped forward. This was when you first sent some stuff out. I know James would probably say the same thing. We read it and said, wow, this is too good to put on the back burner. We can't wait for this one. Let's jump now.
Yeah, you know, we're really in the ninth chapter of Observations for a Time, and this is the 14th. But you know, sometimes
this is too poignant, too much in time of where we are.
Yeah, it's just too poignant. It's it just grabs you. This validates everything we've been saying. Even from the very commencement of this, who's Dode hasn't been around for 300 years. And yet, who's Yahweh singing to?
Dode.
Why is he singing to Dode? Because Dode is essential. Dode is the single most important person in the history of mankind. I know that's hard for a lot of people to accept, because they want it to be their Jesus.
Yeah.
But no, there was no Jesus.
Yosha was Yahweh's Torah, speaking loud.
Yeah, and all Yosha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. So he doesn't exist as an independent human being. And besides that, I want you to tell me, in fact, you could, I want both of you guys to go ahead and start right now. I want you to read for our listeners everything that Yosha wrote down for us to know.
I'm done.
Yeah. That's it. Nothing. Not a word. Not a word.
That's funny.
What do we have from Dode? But 100
tons of
volumes. More songs?
Volumes and volumes.
25 proverbs? Word pictures?
Yeah.
Michelle? And copious, detailed biographical experiences, replete with the dialogue, and words for our time, words of the day, chronicles, and in Melech, Kings, even in Shamuel, listen to him. We have an enormous amount of information in the original language, inspired by the very creator of the universe, about this man. who Yahweh says, I love him. He's right. He's righteous. He's my son. I'm his father. He's not only the most important man who ever lived, we know more about him than we do of anybody else.
Absolutely true.
I would say that, you know, as we have progressed in this study, the thing, you know, we began by, wow, the creation account is precisely accurate scientifically. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Oh, my
that's
God.
Pretty
this
awesome.
Covenant tells you, yeah, it tells you exactly how to participate in it. It tells you what the benefits are. That's pretty awesome. The flood really occurred exactly the way that it said. That's, and it
creation even started the way, exactly the way it said,
yeah.
6 days.
Yeah. The Torah presents the means to benefit from the covenant. Each of the six, you know, Moed, Mikre, play a specific role in that. Man, we found out that the Torah meant teaching. We found out a lot of things along the way. The most recent, by recent I mean last year, maybe 2 years, that has profoundly changed our understanding, and I change maybe is the wrong word, grown, evolved,
yeah.
Developed.
Yeah,
evolved. Our understanding of who Yahweh is and what he is offering are the words and deeds of doubt.
Yeah.
You know, for example, in this case, these people didn't know the Torah and they were unwilling to fight against Yahweh's foes. That's the opposite of Dode. Dode knew the Torah, and he was constantly fighting and condemning Yahweh's enemies, who were his enemies.
No.
Dode is the answer. No, Paul was wrong when he says if you slip up on one of the Torah's rules, you're violating all of them and you're condemned by it, and the Torah can't save. Dode is the living embodiment, proof, of the opposite of that. He's proof that you can come to know Yahweh, engage in a personal relationship with him, and be enriched and empowered and enlightened by him.
Despite your
faith. And that no matter how many flaws you have, God can view you as perfect. It's sensational. It's the person we ought to have been focused on right from the beginning. It's the person Yahweh was focused on.
Yeah, right after the end, he starts back over with Doge, Kingdom of Doge.
Right, and so who
that's
was this song
telling.
To? Yahweh is in the middle of talking about the catastrophic consequence of religion and what's going to happen in the last days, and then he breaks into a song to his beloved.
Hey, let me sing you a song about Doge.
No, I want to sing you a song
wow.
about Doge. Doge wouldn't have stood up for this. Doge would have fought it. I need a Doge. Somewhere out there. You know, to his credit, Yeshayah, when he's brought up to heaven and he's, you know, humbled by the experience there in heaven, and all of a sudden he sees God just frustrated. And so, you know, Yeshayah is saying, he's got to be frustrated because I'm so inadequate. You know, I'm not going to be able to do this anymore. You know, I'm in real trouble here. And God says, no, that's not why I'm frustrated. This fallen nature of man. And it says, you know, God's saying, who is there out there we could even send? Who could represent us? Who can go out with us? And then Yahshua says, hey, I'm here. I've been listening. Send me. And while Yahweh says, listen, if that's what you want, under the auspices of free will, that's okay. But here's what I want you to say, and what he says next, it's just stunning. I can't wait to get to that chapter. But even though Yahshua says, here I am, I'm listening, send me, there's no indication that Yahweh is saying, you know, I really love you. You're my son. Yeah, was he his son? Sure, he was adopted into his family. We're going to get to meet Yahshua in heaven. But there was no one like Dode. He didn't sing a song to Yahshua. You know, the prophets were messengers. Now, Moshe was a messenger. The prophets were all messengers. Dode was far more than that. Dode was the example.
He's the goal. He's what we should strive for.
Yes, absolutely. Be like Dode. If you be like Dode, you're not worried about, you're not sweating the little stuff. You're not worried about, oh, you know, I looked at that girl and really thought she was cute, and I shouldn't have done that because, you know, she's married and I'm married. You just don't care. You know, it's, if you're, say, you know, I'd really like to own that thingamajig, that'd be a lot of fun to own, whatever it might be. Oh, don't own lots of stuff. God doesn't care. What God cares about is, do you care about Him? Are you willing to invest the time to study what He had to say? Are you passionate about understanding who He is and what He's offering? Are you willing to engage? In fact, are you enthusiastic about working with Him, engaging with Him, participating in this relationship with Him? Are you devoted to sharing what you learned? That's who Dode was. So, yeah, that's why Yahweh loved him. Oh, well, I'm going on and on here, but that is the thing that really struck me about this chapter, is it begins with Yahweh singing a love song to Dode because there was no one else like him. He was one in tens of billions. And it's a shame that more people aren't enamored.
Interested in being like him.
Yeah, enamored with him, focused on him. I've never heard anybody else say, you know, we should use Dode as our example. We ought to learn from Dode. I don't even know his name. And he's just so pertinent to this particular example, because Dode was shown weeding the vineyard, turning over the stones in the vineyard, you know, planting the vineyard. He's working with Yahweh. You know, just as Noah did in building the ark, he's working with him. And the thing about Dode, when you read him, there isn't anything that Dode writes where he doesn't take a swipe at his enemies. And that's what needed to happen here. That's why Christianity exists. It's where Israel failed. And there's
See,
no one that understood
the
Torah better.
Disappointed.
Yeah, that's why Yahweh was
disappointed.
He said
I'd protect him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why God was disappointed.
Don't be afraid.
Yep. Exactly. I mean, he's the easiest guy in the world to work for, too. I mean, I'm
certainly enjoyable.
But, you know, I'm not the easiest guy to get along with. You know, he's supportive, he's interested, he's engaging, he's fun to work with, and stunningly rewarding. You know, I don't have a single complaint.
And he teaches you all along the way.
Right, and I've never felt uncomfortable. I mean, that was one of the things that you know, first, my first impression in this next chapter when Yashiah says, he's angry because of me, disappointed because of me, because of all of my inadequacies, but when you read it further, he said what he was disappointed in is that Yahweh wouldn't continue to use him to speak on his behalf. He wasn't worried about Yahweh striking him or that Yahweh somehow was going to exclude him from the company. That didn't even enter his mind. It's just that he enjoyed sharing Yahweh's message. That's what he wanted to do. Dode enjoyed studying the Torah and writing about it, singing about it. Both of them wanted to engage in doing the most fun job in the world, the job that we're doing. You know, they got it directly from Yahweh. We're getting it directly from them. We're getting it directly from them. That's I'd actually like it this way. I mean, there's more enjoyment, less responsibility. You know, we make mistakes.
I'm all for
time.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the greatest job in the world. It's all upside, no downside. All benefit, no detriment. All opportunity, no real responsibility. Couldn't be better.
Well, they're not crawling out of the trenches everywhere to jump on board.
No, they're just, you know, it's a pretty small number of people. You know, one of the things I found interesting,
What are they missing that we're seeing?
Yeah, you know, there was a time where we had a lot more people that were, you start a show, and that chat room would be overflowing. Now you start a show, and it's not overflowing. Now, there's a lot more people that are listening to the archives now. And there's more people that that listen by the phone than listen and participate in the chat room. But, you know, nonetheless, there's a limited number of people who are
the ones that are very solid.
Yeah, the ones that are.
Yeah. They're all engaged. More and more of them are engaged in transiting and looking for themselves. So that's, I think, that's great.
Yes. Yep, but I finally found the reason why we had to go through the turmoil of those who were previously engaged with us, but turned out to be Ross. And had it not occurred, I would never have been understood why the instructions to Yashaya were, okay, if you want to go, this is what I want you to say. And what he says is exactly my reaction when I took responsibility for the people who parroted the terms and the name without understanding. Yeah, it was what G.I. was trying to avoid. It's really compelling stuff. So I'll tell you, I'm having fun. Well, we have a lot more to talk about. And we'll just continue to move through it. We're out of the time that we're even going to record. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. We got a lot more to cover, even in Yashaya 5. We haven't got to the good part yet.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, we haven't got to the best part yet. Yeah, it even gets better. Although this is a pretty profound statement right here, the one we just finished with. God has a lot to say about this one man, because this one man cost more people their souls than anyone else, and maybe more than everyone else combined. Yeah.
It's so obvious when you start reading it, though.
It is. Why he's so disgusted by Shaul. Yep, and all those churches where they worship their God, they only knew their God is the one who wants to be worshipped. And the real God has no interest in being worshipped. Just a touch of logic would do them all some good. Well, good night, fellas. It's been
good evening.
My pleasure.
All right. I'll talk to you next week.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
Bye-bye.
Happy Shabbat.
Shabbat.